If you wish to become a complete and wise leader, you must embrace a larger view of the Force.
Welcome, everyone. My name is DeVore, and you are listening to episode 43 of A Larger View of the Force, a Star Wars podcast. A reminder, as always, if this is your first time listening, please do go check out the earlier episodes of this show and make sure you're subscribed so you keep up to date with new episodes as they come out. So today's episode is a very, very special episode, an episode that is very near and dear to my heart. It is about two things that are very close to me and that have been an important part of the DNA of the show really since the beginning, and that is Star Wars and history and their intersection. So this is, you know, for regular listeners, for longtime listeners of the show, will know that this is something that I've talked about a lot. It was something I talked about in the very first episode back when I was talking about what this show was going to be about. And I did an episode early on, a sort of meta episode where I kind of talked about Star Wars as a sort of work of history. I'll come back to some of those ideas in the context of this conversation. And then I've done a number of different episodes really over the course of the history of the show, looking at certain parallels and comparisons that we can draw between certain stories and events in the world of Star Wars and then certain events from our own world from the past. And, you know, for anyone who's tuning in, who's listening to the show maybe for the first time or is listening in order to hear our special guests, I will put a link in the episode description to some of the kind of history themed episodes of the show so that you can kind of easily go in there and go check those out if you're interested. But yes, as I have teased, and if you heard at the end of the previous episode when I talked about this episode, I have two very special guests who have joined me for this conversation. I very much look forward to. I mean, the genesis of this episode was the publication of a book that came out in August of this year of 2022 by one of the guests that is going to be joining me. And so this is going to be really kind of wide-ranging conversation about both Star Wars and history and then kind of their intersection, and talking about really a sort of a conversation about what we get out of marrying these two together. What is the byproduct of kind of talking about this pop culture franchise and trying to contextualize and looking at the intersections of real world history in the past and so on, what we get out of it. And then almost at also kind of meta level to talk about, like, what is it, you know, producing, you know, making Star Wars content, being a Star Wars content creator at this kind of intersection of Star Wars and history. And so those are some of the things, among other things, I'm sure that we will touch on in this conversation. But first, I want to introduce the guests that I have with me for this conversation. These are two people who are both working in this very Venn diagram as I am. And so I couldn't think of two better people to have on to have this conversation. So first, she is the co-host of The Joy of Star Wars, as well as the podcast Impressions of America. Vaughn Joy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on, for agreeing to do this. Guest number two.
Yeah.
He is the reason we are doing this episode. He is the author of the aforementioned book that came out back in August, that is The History and Politics of Star Wars, Death Stars, and Democracy. He's also a co-author on the book Star Wars Battles That Changed the Galaxy. He is also a historian in his own right. He is the author of British, French, and American Relations on the Western Front, 1914 to 1918, and also The First World War in Computer Games. Chris Kempshall, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm sure I'm not the reason that this podcast is happening right now. I would have quite happily come along and listened to you and Vaughn talk, regardless of books coming out.
Well, yeah, I mean, I heard about your book, and then I heard about you on another podcast, and I was like, okay, I got to get this guy on. I got to talk about him, because this is the kind of stuff that I've been doing. I know Vaughn on your show, Joy of Star Wars, this is what you guys have been also doing a lot of, and so yeah, it just really worked out in order to be able to kind of bring you both together on for this particular topic. Where I want to start off first is pretty much where I usually start off with first-time guests on the show, which is that I ask them about their journeys into Star Wars, so sort of how they became a fan and their fandom involved. But because of the particular nature of this episode and this conversation that we have, I do want to talk about that. But then I also want to talk about our kind of respective journeys into the discipline of history. Because this podcast episode is, I kind of mentioned this to you guys over DMs when I reached out to you with this idea, which is that this episode is, of course, you know, it's the kind of alpha and omega of it is going to be Star Wars, because this is a Star Wars podcast. But then it's, you know, all three of us have various, you know, trainings and backgrounds and kind of have done work in the discipline of history. So this episode is also going to be a little bit about like three history people just kind of shooting the shit. That's also sort of what I had in mind for this, you know, in addition to talking about Star Wars. So I do want to, you know, when I talk about like journeys into history, I want to get into the like, okay, what were the like professors you had? What were the books you read? Like, I want to get into like all that stuff. And I don't know how interesting, like to how many listeners that's going to be interesting to, but it's my show and I don't care. And I want to have this conversation.
Fair enough.
So we're going to do the journey into Star Wars and a history conversation. So let's start with, I'll start with you, Vaughn. So let's start on the kind of journey into Star Wars. Talk a little bit about your kind of fandom.
When I was a very little kid, I remember kind of walking past the living room and my dad was watching what I soon learned to be A New Hope. And I remember seeing C-3PO on the TV, and I just kind of stopped in the hallway, like right in the doorway of the living room, and I watched for a good 45 minutes, just kind of transfixed. I think I was about 4 or 5 years old. And ever since then, I've just been obsessed with Star Wars. I remember like going to a yard sale with my dad, and he gave me $10 and said, go buy something that you really want. I came back with the gold VHS box of the original trilogy. And he said, I've never been prouder of you. And I think I was about 9 years old then. So that was a real kind of moment as a kid. And I watched the originals on VHS for sure. But then my grandfather gave me Attack of the Clones for my 8th birthday on DVD. And I watched that probably every day for like a couple years. So Attack of the Clones is actually the one that I've seen the most. And then coming forward, I've really enjoyed it. When I was in college when the sequels were coming out and the anthology films, so I went to the midnight premieres of those on my own sometimes. It just really grew into something I love. And on Impressions of America, I kind of bullied my co-hosts into letting me do a Star Wars and American History episode. And it was one of our most popular ones at the time. So my co-host Simon on that podcast asked if I wanted to start a whole history Star Wars podcast in its own right, and it's just been a passion project for all of 2022 since we started.
All right, yeah, and yeah, you guys have done some really, you know, compelling episodes so far. You've done these kind of connections and stuff that I have not even thought about. So yeah, I've really been enjoying what you guys have been doing on there.
Thank you, I appreciate that a lot.
So Chris, yeah, same question to you.
I mean, to begin with, firstly, I feel like deep in my bones, we should find some way to introduce Vaughn to Anthony Daniels and just kind of have a 4-year-old child's realization moment.
Yes. Yes.
If you're listening, Anthony Daniels, it would make my life.
Yes, Anthony Daniels, fan of the show.
Yeah, I'm sure he is. Trust me. What else?
Reach out to Vaughn.
So my routine is that when I was growing up, we had recorded the original trilogy, except for The Empire Strikes Back, whether or not we'd lost that VHS or it'd been recorded over. We recorded the A New Hope and Return of the Jedi off of the VHS on TV over here in England in like the 1980s. And I watched those VHS videos a lot. To the extent that now, if I was to watch it on, like, yeah, I was saying earlier, I went to watch Return of the Jedi in concert last night at the Royal Albert Hall, and they had a full orchestra and that playing, and it was fantastic, it was brilliant, but there weren't advert breaks where I expect there to be. You know, Luke Skywalker lights up his lightsaber and he, you know, cleaves off the front part of a speeder bike and it spins into a tree and it explodes. And then it should cut to an advert about R. White's Lemonade in the 1980s. And then I can, you know, there's a whole R. White's Lemonade song and I should be able to sing along. And that's my kind of my entry of the film aspect. And then, you know, I played a variety of Star Wars computer games and in the early to mid 90s. But then I went on holiday to Florida in 1997, and there used to be in downtown Disney a really big Virgin megastore there, and I went in and I was looking at the books and sci-fi books, and I saw Timothy Zahn's novel Spectre of the Past, and I like Star Wars, I like books, so I bought it and I gobbled it up in 15 minutes. And that's when I then kind of moved into the next evolution of my kind of Star Wars geekdom, where I, you know, hoovered up the expanded universe novels, and then the prequels were coming out, and then I played more Star Wars computer games, and it kind of just sort of escalated rapidly from that, where I think kind of Star Wars fandom became one of the overriding aspects of my personality, in, you know, replacing, you know, the ability to talk normally to human beings, because I don't need that in the same way that I need Star Wars. So yeah, I think that's kind of how it's been for me. Yeah, particularly from the kind of mid to late 90s, where it's just kind of been accelerating Star Wars.
All right, okay, that's interesting. Yeah, you sort of talk about, you know, you talk about, you mentioned the importance of books, you know, Star Wars books into that. And of course, you know, in your own book, you make a lot of that, particularly the kind of old expanded universe. So, okay, you can see sort of the roots of how that kind of came to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we got a little sense from, you know, from both of you about, you know, how you became Star Wars fans. But then, as I mentioned, there's the other side of the coin in this conversation, which is sort of how you also became into history and how you ended up sort of pursuing that as a kind of, you know, in both a kind of avocational capacity and then also in a vocational capacity. And then we'll kind of marry those two sides of the conversation and sort of talk about them. So I guess I'll go backwards in backwards order now and ask Chris for to kind of talk about how, like, tell me about your sort of the history of your engagement with history and kind of how that came to be.
I'm going to horribly out myself now as basically being a fake historian. Because for those of you who don't, you know, who haven't gone through the British education system, you go to secondary school and you have a variety of courses that you take, including history. At which point, when you get to year 9, which is about halfway through, you then get to decide which courses you want to keep, which options you want to take. And I dropped history and didn't study it again until my master's and PhD, really, because I wanted to be a sports commentator, particularly a football soccer commentator. So I studied media, lots and lots of media. That was my kind of the option to at GCSE, and then at A level, which is what you do in England before you go to college, which is the equivalent of college, and then before you go to university. And then at university, for my undergraduate, I did media studies with a few kind of little history courses along the side, but mainly because I just wanted to break up kind of the media studies aspect of it, and I wanted to be a football commentator. And then I got to the end of my undergraduate and realised it's really hard to be a football commentator because there aren't that many football matches played every week and you don't need that many human beings to talk about them. So I kind of panicked and then decided to, I'll do a master's, and it was in contemporary war and peace studies, which was sort of international relations with an element of history in it, basically because I didn't know what else to do. And this, I'd done these school courses, including a course on the First World War, in my undergraduate, kind of along the side of it, and I really enjoyed those. And then I finished my MA and was super tired and went out into the real world for a while. God, it's dreadful. The real world has very little to recommend it. It's just, I've seen it, I've tried it, it's not for me. And, you know, having come to the realization that, you know, because it's really hard to be a football commentator, the obvious solution of a far easier field to break into is academia. So I decided to do a PhD in the First World War. And that's where I streamlined mainly into kind of history from then onwards. And yeah, everything else has kind of emerged from that. But even from that little story, you know, the stuff that I've done with, you know, normal First World War is obviously kind of First World War now and international relations, but the computer game stuff is drawing on the media studies. Star Wars is definitely drawing on the media studies. So this kind of weird Frankenstein's monster approach has sort of paid off in a kind of misshapen way further down the line, but it wasn't really through any kind of like cunning strategic plan.
And you know you talked about, you know, you mentioned about your kind of specialty within the First World War. I always kind of have like a special place in my heart for, like, I don't know, people who like do things in the First World War and study, because I just feel like, and I mean, I, you know, I could be speaking from a kind of US centric view here, because I know things are different in particular in Europe. And I mean, not even like, you can't even draw that line, but even like you take Europe plus Canada, particularly in the US, like there's much less of a kind of collective memory of the First World War.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't figure as much in terms of, you know, again, the kind of national history and national identity, the way that it does in a Britain, in a France, or even, let's say, a Canada.
Yeah, everyone gets seduced by the big budget sequel with the, you know, the bigger battles and explosions and the cinematic bad guy, but it doesn't have that kind of the heart and soul of the original.
Yeah, so
the best explanation I've ever heard of the World Wars.
It really is. It's very good.
Yeah,
I can't imagine why I struggle to find work at times. It's a mystery to me.
Yeah, and anytime like someone says like they're doing something in First World War, I'm a little bit like, you're like, go you, like that's good. Like, more people need to learn about the First World War. It gets glossed over so much.
Yeah, and I appreciate the affirmation.
All right, what about you, Vaughn?
So talk about a Frankenstein's monster. I have had a very weird path to get where I am. In undergrad, I couldn't decide, so I did two bachelors, one in classical languages, so Latin and Greek, and then one in American history, but specified around the Revolution. But I did my senior thesis in undergrad on comics from the early 1900s through World War II. And then I kind of rolled the dice for what I was doing in my master's. And I decided, because I looked down at one of my textbooks and it said that the person who wrote it went to Trinity College Dublin. And I was like, I'll do that. So I went to Trinity and studied a master's in classics, and then decided that was not something I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I came over to London and did a master's in history and studied comic books again with a classical reception kind of lens on it. So I was using both. And then now I'm doing my PhD in Christmas film history from the post-war period in the US. So I study Hollywood and government involvement in the motion picture industry. And I had no training for that at all. So I've specialized in four different eras at this point, and really just kind of jumped into media studies, film studies for my PhD. So I've been all over the shop.
Gosh, yeah, you really run the gamut, even just within U.S. history.
Yeah, I did the whole thing.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah, you went colonial all the way to contemporary.
That's a great buffet of topics.
Yeah, it really
Thank
is.
You, yeah. I have a lot of fun with it. I tell my students all the time to keep it weird. Just study whatever you want to study, because as long as you can make an argument, somebody will let you write it.
God, hear, hear.
Yes, yeah. Oh, that is 100% correct. I mean, you know, in my own case, in my own kind of journey with history, I mean, there is a little bit of the same kind of grab bag that both of you guys have talked about, which is that I sort of knew I wanted to do history for a while. So I'm going to really out myself here also, much like Krista. This is really the confessional podcast, which is that I was an ancient Egypt kid, like Ooh, very hard ancient Egypt cool. kid. Yeah. I was one of those kids. Yeah. And like, I think that was, as far as I can remember, like my first sort of like career aspiration, like when people ask like, what did you want to be when you were a kid? I think it might've been Egyptologist, honestly, as well as I can remember. So I kind of had that as a, at least a kind of broad direction of where I wanted to go for, You know, like particularly in high school and all that, I was probably thinking like, oh, I might, you know, become like a social studies teacher or something like that. That's kind of what in the vein of what I was thinking. Then like I started kind of, as I got into kind of end of high school and then going into college, I started adding little things here and there. I was a senior in high school. And as a senior, when you're in New York State, they make you take an economics class, just a part of like state graduating requirement. And I happened to be taking mine in the fall of 2008. So I literally started this class, and then 3 weeks in, like the bottom went out. And so it was this really kind of weird time to be doing this, where you're learning all this sort of theory and all this stuff, and then like the world is on fire around you. And so I started kind of getting into that and being really interested in that element. And then when I went into college, I picked up other things. Like I started taking some philosophy classes and getting interested into that. And then, you know, I kind of knew that I wanted to go into grad school, but then there was a little bit of time where I was like, do I want to stick with history? Maybe go the econ route. Maybe that has more in the way of, you know, career prospects, etc. And ultimately decided to stick with my first love, which was history. And then went grad school, the PhD route and all that. But then, you know, much like, you know, the two of you guys were talking about with your own background, like I ended up pulling, even though the main route was history for me, I ended up pulling a lot of those other disciplines and other interests in. Mm. So like my research ended up being, I was kind of focused on sort of modern US, particularly kind of post-war. And I was looking at a lot of like the intersection of kind of political and economic history. My dissertation ended up being on the company Amway. And I did stuff for like multi-level marketing. Like that was my whole dissertation. And that was a lot of fun. So in a similar way, I kind of had I had a kind of Frankensteinian grab bag of things that I was interested in. And then, you know, to what you were saying, Vaughn, which is like, keep it weird, like just make the argument as out there as it might be, so long as you can find the stuff that backs it. Like that was what I was doing also. So I'm curious for you guys, you know, you sort of touched on this a little bit when you were talking about your respective journeys. But like for either of you or for both of you, were there any things like any real world moments or any particular people or classes or whatnot that kind of influenced your journey on history or that kind of fed into that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Go ahead.
I actually got to interview this person last month on Impressions, which was like a dream come true for me. I was fawning the entire time. But in my senior year of undergrad, I had also started in that university's graduate program. So I was taking grad classes as well as undergrad. And in the grad class, one of the best professors I've ever had, Dr. Ryan, he's a fantastic person. I told him the other day that I interviewed this person and we both freaked out about it. He introduced me to a book. And everyone was supposed to have their choice of what book they were going to do their report on for this class, their first one. And he gave me this book and he said, you are going to do this because I need to know what you think about it. And it was Comic Strips and Consumer Culture by Ian Gordon. And this book absolutely changed my life because I had never read a cultural history before. I didn't know that you could study comics or like movies or the things that I love and have a historical argument for it. And it absolutely changed my life. And that's why I pivoted in my senior year to write my thesis on comics instead of some argument I was going to make about the revolution. I don't even remember what it was now. And that really, it just opened up the whole world to me, realizing that you can keep it weird and write whatever you want as long as there's a historical argument that you can back up. It just really like released this passion in me. So Ian Gordon, he's on Twitter. You should follow him. He's fantastic. He also wrote a book on Superman as a persevering kind of icon of Americana. And it is such a good book.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Everyone should read it if you like comics. I'm sorry, I'm gushing all over again because I just got to meet him.
So I've got like kind of two halves of this. So during the undergraduate, what I told you about when I was doing media practice and theory, I took a school course, which was actually set in English, in the School of English, about kind of the writing and poetry about the First World War. which I'd never really studied before, but it sounded interesting, and it, you know, sounded like something that could be fun. And at one point in it, the lecturer for it was talking to us about the concept of the myth of the First World War, which was, he broke it down as, you know, the way that we remember the First World War isn't actually a reflection of what happened at the time and necessarily of the experiences of people who took part in it. And that blew my mind, that the idea that you might remember history wrong or differently from the events that have ever happened. I mean, in an element that makes me want to put my head in my hands, I am, you know, deeply, deeply stupid that this had never occurred to me before, that there might be different ways of remembering the past. And also in a manner that, you know, God, my students would roll their eyes at me, given the ways that I've kind of then explained this to them ever since. But that triggered something in me of, well, you know, what else therefore could be being remembered differently, and the kind of the divergence of memories. And I carried that forward into what was going to be my PhD topic, which was, you know, is there a comparable myth of the war in France as there is to Britain? And it was going to be a kind of comparative PhD study, which I was super excited for. But then I discovered that basically people had done everything that you would do for that study, except for the comparison already. And, you know, taking a bunch of stuff that other people have written and then putting it next to each other doesn't really a PhD make, which kind of upset me and, you know, led to the first of many existential PhD crises. And then because in the lead up to this, I'd read a book by Dan Todman called The Great War, Myth and Memory, which I adored and thought was fantastic and still think is fantastic. And is kind of the book to read about the evolution of Britain's memory of war. Of the First World War. But then I read an article by a historian called Elizabeth Greenhalgh, who had done an article based on her MA thesis, which was a brief study of what French soldiers thought about British soldiers around the Somme in 1916. And that completely changed my entire topic of my PhD. The PhD then became about what did British and French soldiers think about each other across the entirety of the war. And that article is still like the most meaningful article that I have ever read, because it completely changed every aspect of the way that I was going to approach the subject. And if we're going to talk about kind of gushing about people, I had several moments of huge anxiety of trying to introduce myself to Elizabeth Greenhalgh at a conference once, because she was just like my academic hero. Then when the book of my thesis came out, I emailed her to ask if she would be basically blurb the back of it. And it took me, I swear to God, 6 weeks to build up the courage to email her to ask her for this. And she agreed, and she wrote a lovely thing for the back cover. And I found out later on that she'd also been the blind or the peer reviewer for it, the publishers had gone to. So she'd signed off on the book in the lead up to it. And I only figured it out because she mentioned something in an email to me that she couldn't have known about if she hadn't already read the manuscript. And yeah, that just made me insanely happy. But then the sad aspect is that she then died shortly after the book was coming out. And I hadn't realized, and nobody had really realized, that she'd been kind of suffering from cancer, I think, in the lead up to it. So she'd done all of this whilst undertaking like chemotherapy. And I just thought that was just the most amazing kind of touching, but awful thing that could have happened around that. And yeah, so that article still means the world to me.
Oh, wow. That's a story.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it's like I was surprisingly upset when I found out that she died, but I was definitely upset when I found out that she died. Sure. Pulled the tone of that one down.
You really did.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We've had a lovely time.
There was something in particular that you mentioned, Chris, there that really kind of stood out to me when you were talking about how you had this eureka moment in the class about how the professor who told you that history can be remembered differently or wrongly, and all that. And it makes me think about, yeah, the way that we present history, particularly at sort of a younger level. Like, I think about, I mean, maybe I will be speaking, you know, only to my own experience, or some of this will resonate with the both of you. But I think about, you know, your middle school, your high school history, like, it is presented in, you know, in literal textbook fashion.
Yeah.
In most cases, mm-hmm. where, like, you're given a particular narrative, and then it's not really, unless you happen to pursue history at a more advanced level, if you take courses at, you know, at a college level or so on, that you get more of that idea of history as a kind of contested thing, or even just this, or even the notion of like, you know, you even have to go, I would even think in my own training, like you still have to go even like further up within, you know, within a university training to get to the idea of like historiography, you know, like that idea of like, oh, the history of certain things has changed over time, or like the way that certain stories have been told or certain histories have been told has been changed over time. So yeah, I that sort of stood out to me when you said that, because I'm like, yeah, I think that is a kind of, I think that would be an aha moment for a lot of people.
It definitely was for me a moment of like, history is not an objective truth. What? Like, I've been told that for so long. That's actually a difference between the US and the UK that I've noticed, because I am American. I grew up in Philly and went to undergrad in Philly and then did grad school abroad. And now I teach at my university. Historiography was something that we didn't touch until senior year of undergrad in Philly. But historiography is literally the first day of my writing class for my first year students in the UK.
Yeah.
Like literally the first day we talk about historiography and that there is not an objective truth to history. And we need to interrogate and interpret history. So it's a really profound kind of difference between the two education systems.
One of the kind of things that was described to me when I was, you know, basically trying to get a crash course in studying history when I started my PhD, which, you know, possibly a little late in the day to be learning the norms of the field. But, you know, the description of, you know, the way that you get taught it at school is exactly as you said, you know, here's a bunch of objective 100%, you know, pure facts. Whereas the study of history at university is the study of historians rather than necessarily of events. Of competing visions of the past. And I imagine one of the things, I mean, it definitely annoys me, and I imagine it must kind of to varying extents annoy both of you as well, is this kind of, it's a culture wars thing of that, you know, to insert an argument into the writing of history is to somehow betray the purity of the field, when to study and write history is to make an argument. It's, you're describing is a chronicler rather than a historian, and...
Yeah.
This idea, oh, you know, you've just rewritten history. It's like, well, that's what historians do. Which of us is confused about this? Because I don't feel it's me.
That's literally the job.
Yeah.
That's why we still have a job, is we're revising and going back and changing the lens and saying, we know that these events happened, but what else can we dig out of this? Whose perspective can we see it from now? That's the whole job. And that's why it's so fun.
Yeah. Unnecessary.
Yeah. And necessary. Yeah, so necessary.
I mean, Chris, I'm gonna be thinking about that line of yours about how like history at universities is like talking about historians. Cause like, man, that's so true.
It is.
It's the best one sentence description I've ever heard of like advanced history.
Yeah, here's a bunch of people, here's what they wrote, and now we gotta try to understand why they thought and said the things they thought and said.
But yeah, so I mean, I think this is probably a good point there, and maybe now to transition to kind of starting to marry these two topics and start to talk about Star Wars and history together. Yeah, so to kind of go into that, I think, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, we've touched on just there, we had a little bit of like the historiography discussion and so on, and I want to kind of come back to that idea because I think it's going to be important. But I think a good first place to start to kind of talk about this is before we even get into like talking anything about, well, like, you know, what can we get out of drawing these comparisons and so on and so forth, is to really kind of talk about like, or ask the question of like, what does it mean to look at history like to look at Star Wars like a historian? Because I think like we first have to get like the meta level of like method. So like what, you know, what as historians, as people kind of trained in the discipline of history, like, what do we bring to now, not looking at events in the past or looking at arguments that historians make, but actually when we sit down and watch Star Wars or read Star Wars or what have you. So I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
I mean, my part of my experience, I mean, you know, and it's depressing, is, you know, to watch Star Wars or read Star Wars as a historian is to an extent to ruin it for yourself. That's been my experience in the past 5 years to varying degrees. But I think what it is that we bring to it is the ability to place the books or the films or the games into a framework of context, because our job as historians is, and this is exactly what Vaughan was talking about in regards to historiography, is to take a history book from the 1960s and say, okay, you know, this is what the history book says, but let's look at the world around the creation of this history book and try and figure out what might be going on in the background that might be influencing the content. You know, what did the author know? What's going on around them? What do they see every day? And once you realize, you know, that is a framework that is transportable, you can put it on top of anything you want. And there's no reason why you shouldn't put it on top of a, you know, a Star Wars film released in 1977 and go, okay, what is the context of the creation of this thing? What if we treat this exactly like it was a history book? Who is the author? What are the topics touched within it? What's going on in the world around its creation? And what might that tell us that is, you know, reasonably interesting and useful?
I would definitely agree with that. I am now a film historian, so every film is ruined for me, pretty much.
And we thank you for your service.
You're welcome. That's not true. My supervisor told me to never study a film, like one of my favorite films, because I'll ruin it for myself. So I took up that challenge and did my first paper on Pretty Woman. And I was like, I still love this film. So I'm going to write my dissertation on Christmas films.
Yay!
And now I'm like, how many more times can I watch It's a Wonderful Life? But anyway, with Star Wars, it feels like just an extension of the rest of my work a little bit. But it is about that context and fitting it into what was Hollywood doing at the time of Star Wars release? And what was Reagan doing? Who did George Lucas draw these influences from? Is there something that we can map onto Star Wars that isn't necessarily an influence for George Lucas, but would be something that the audience would bring with them from American history, just from being in the world? In my other work, I don't really do a lot of audience reception, but here on Joy of Star Wars, I get to do much more thinking about, like, what did the audience actually bring with them when they sat in the cinema and watched Hollywood change forever with Star Wars in 77. So yeah, I think it's a lot of just that cultural, social, political, historical context that you can bring to the film, and it really shifts the way you view it or view certain messages within it, or even things that aren't said, things that are just in the background. Why are they there? Somebody made a conscious decision to put that in or word something specifically in that way. Why did they do it? So that's kind of my view on it, I guess.
That audience perception aspect is super interesting, a really great way of approaching it, because a lot of the conversation always ends up around being like, oh, you know, you're making us try to assume that the, you know, the directors and the actors are these kind of ahistorical vacuums and they're not projecting anything with them. But the other half of that arrangement is clearly like, why do you think that everybody in the cinema is also an apolitical vacuum and are bringing absolutely nothing with them when they sit down and watch a film? They've already selected it as something they want to watch because they're interested in the topic, and that alone shows you that, you know, they have their own interests and desires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're totally right. I like the way you both sort of bring that up of, you know, thinking about and analyzing a piece of media from both of those ends, from on the one hand, what the creators bring to bear on it and what may have been on their minds, what may have been their influences, what are they kind of putting into as they are making the thing, whether it's a movie, whether it's a book, whether it's whatever. And then also on the other end of the equation, which is the audience who's consuming it, and what they're bringing and what they may be kind of interpolating into the media, into the text. I think both half of those are really important in terms of, if you want to take something like a Star Wars and you want to situate it in, you know, if you take, let's say, the first film in the context of the late 70s, or, you know, the prequels in the context of the early 2000s or anything like that. You know, when we talk about the intersection of Star Wars and history, I think there's sort of two levels at which you can have the conversation or kind of look at it, which is, on the one hand, there is, you can talk about it at the way that we've been talking about it, which is like, you look at all these media, the books, the movies, and so on, and then you talk about them, you know, in the context of the time in which they were made, the people who made them, and so on. But then I think there's also the second level, and I think this is something that is unique, particularly to Star Wars, which is that Star Wars is a thing set in the past. The very first, like, if you just pop in to watch A New Hope and you don't know anything about Star Wars and you're starting from the very beginning, the very first thing that you learn about Star Wars is that it happened a long time ago, which distinguishes it from a lot of other sci-fi franchises, because most of them are about an imagined future, whether it's a Star Trek, whether it's a Battlestar Galactica, anything else. But Star Wars has this premise of, no, this is, you're actually watching events that have taken place centuries, millennia, however long in the past. So I think that's really interesting, you know, coming at the historical lens, because there's, you know, you can come at it as a historian on the one hand and talk about, okay, well, what was happening in the world and so on when the prequels are made? But then another aspect to looking at Star Wars like a historian is these things are about, this media is about things that have happened in the past. So I want to ask you guys, what are your thoughts on that? Like, what significance do you think is there to the fact that Star Wars takes place in the past? Like, do you think there's any particular ways that it affects the story being told?
Do you want to go first of all?
I sure. Apologize in advance. I apologize if this is giving you guys like quals or comps, like post-traumatic stress, because all of these questions I wrote them down like, damn, these are all very deep questions.
It's a really fascinating question, and one that admittedly I haven't really thought about in terms of Star Wars. The thing that I think about most with Star Wars is how time functions within the kind of cinematic universe that is unfolding still, and how it's been so enduring for 45 years, that they jump around temporally. And you go in the past within the Star Wars universe that we are aware of, and then you go forward into the future, and then you go into the past again, depending on what media you're watching or is being released at the time. That's something that I think about a lot more, because that gives us so many different advantages, and it gives the creators so many different advantages than something like, say, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But Star mm-hmm. Wars itself being in the past is a really fascinating question, because we don't know what the present is in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah,
are we the present for the Star Wars universe? I don't think so, but maybe.
We've lost a lot of cool technology if we are.
Yeah, there are some gaps. I think that's an aspect of history that for me is really important, is knowing the present, knowing what happens next after the event that you're studying. So you can connect to these things and inform better. But it also, this question brings up, now I'm just kind of musing on it because you asked, this question brings up all of that stuff that we just said about what we study in history, that there are different lenses, there are different perspectives, there are different theories that you can take, and there is no objective truth. So are we meant to take Star Wars as an interpretation of what happened? And if so, is that why everything is kind of geared around the Skywalkers? Maybe that's what we're getting with Andor. Is seeing somebody else's perspective on things. And that's why Rogue One was so popular, because it wasn't about the Skywalkers. It wasn't about the standard view of Star Wars history that we know. It was about someone else's perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a really super interesting point. And that feeling of, okay, you know, stories of ancient Greek legends were written a long time ago, but I don't necessarily feel that we should, you know, treat them as if they are 100% accurate retellings of the past. I think there were less minotaurs in the world than is otherwise portrayed within the pages of certain Greek epics. But that's because it's not designed necessarily to be a history book. You know, it's creating a version of history, but it's, you know, it has to be understood as a fictionalized tale, which makes, you know, them wonder whether or not, you know, is this how we should be taking Star Wars? That, you know, all these people with lightsabers and using the Force and the like, you know, how much of that is just artistic license for a story of a, you know, a princess who got kidnapped and taken to an evil fortress? Because it's drawing on that, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away is exactly the same as once upon a time in a faraway kingdom, there was a hero and a villain and a princess and all of those aspects. You know, it's wedding that fairy tale story structure with science fiction, but then we sit there and we take it as the literal truth. But we probably wouldn't take it as the literal truth, as, you know, oh wow, yeah, I absolutely believe that if you put a hat and a bed sheet and a you know, and a nightgown on a wolf, it will definitely look like an old woman. I believe that entirely. That I can't imagine how that could possibly be confusing or unlikely. And you just wouldn't do it with Red Riding Hood. But so why would we necessarily just take this unknown narrator's view that, you know, this is definitely what happened in the war against the Empire?
Yeah, like, I particularly, like, in this context, I'm thinking about the early part of your book, Chris, where you talk about, you know, where you're talking about legends and canon. And you're talking about those as like how to think of those at a kind of historiographical level or like as kind of accounts of this past. And then, yeah, that sort of gets, you know, Vaughn sort of gets this earlier, like, are we meant to see Star Wars, the story of Star Wars, as like a particular account of these events that happened a long time ago, as opposed to the account of things that happened a long time ago? And I think, yeah, if you bring in the kind of legends element of it all, like, if you put that aside, then you think, okay, well, are we just getting multiple different interpretations or multiple different stories?
Can I say, with that canon aspect, for a while with the book, because, you know, Star Wars fans were obsessed with the concept of canon in regards to the Star Wars, but, you know, overlooking the kind of the religious biblical aspect of it. And for a while, I was toying with a structure and an approach to it that basically translated the expanded universe and everything around Star Wars into almost like gospels. So you have the Gospel of George Lucas, and then you have, you know, the Gospel of Timothy Zahn, and then you have the Gospel of Dave Filoni, all of them operating with the same understanding of the, you know, the central rules, but, you know, here are the stories that I think happened, and that kind of way of understanding Star Wars.
Oh, that's really interesting. I do too.
It became super unwieldy to try and use, but I still think it's compelling enough to have something to it.
Yeah,
theoretically, that's fantastic. Like, love that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to approach it. And I mean, like, you know, I thought about, because, you know, you use the example of, you made the reference to like Greek mythology or Roman mythology, and, you know, I've started thinking recently about whether, you know, within the context of the Star Wars universe or like the Star Wars history, like, do, like, ought we to think about something like legends in a similar fashion, you know, like as these stories that contain people and elements of it that are true, but then these other elements that are more fantastical, like a la something like real world mythologies, where it's like, for example, like for a long time, people assumed Troy did not actually exist and that it was just a mythology. And then, yeah, lo and behold, we found, hey, the city was actually there. So, like, is legends like that also like, okay, there was a Han and a Luke and a Leia and a Darth Vader and an Emperor Palpatine, but...
Yeah, not necessarily as you would recognize them.
Yeah.
There was an Alderaan. Was.
Oh, God. That's true in every version. Every timeline, there was an Alderaan. God.
That's quite dark.
Yes. I mean, actually, to kind of stick on that kind of train of thought of, again, like looking at like Star Wars as a kind of work of history in itself, like, does that, if you think about it in that way, like, does being a historian for either of you, like, does it change the way that you consume Star Wars content on that level? Like, if you look at what certain characters are saying or their intentions, like, are you reading those as you would read, you know, any other kind of historical work or any other kind of historical actor?
I had trouble turning it off watching Andor, but that's because, again, you know, they're being very, very explicit with it in the first three episodes, to my mind, about what it is that they're trying to say. So I think, you know, to use a Star Warsism, I think once you start, you know, going down the dark path of analysing it as history, it will forever dominate your destiny, and you can't stop. Which, you know, makes it slightly tricky to enjoy things just on surface value, but it does mean that you kind of end up analysing it on two levels. You know, why is this character in Andor doing this particular thing? What does it tell us about, you know, this character's motivations and their beliefs? You know, if I was to treat them as a real person. But then you also have the, you know, what is the director and the production team and everybody behind it trying to tell me by the actions and approaches and ideology of this character? So, you know, you give agency to the character in regards to, you know, they are taking control of their own actions and their own kind of desires and the like, but also the understanding that, you know, they're not really, somebody has decided this for them behind the scenes, and that's why it's happening. Yeah. So you kind of end up carving it up on two levels.
I definitely agree with that. There's the production side of it, and then also just the kind of value of the literature, the film text itself that you're analyzing there. For me, because of my kind of Frankenstein's background, I started in classics and analyzed mythology and ancient literature so much in my earlier years as a historian and classicist. So I think I approach films differently. I mean, my supervisor has said as much, that I don't approach them like a film historian, I approach them like a classicist. It's a different kind of connection with, as you guys have both said, ancient mythologies and literature that you have. It's not taking something super literally. It's knowing that there are so many different kinds of allusions that they put in and references to other things, that everything is kind of symbolic, like 90% of the time, and you have to figure out what that symbol is. And that's what my first thesis was on, with demons in mythologies. I think I bring a lot of that to Star Wars, and I did even before I started kind of analyzing it as a historian and for this podcast. I think it is really difficult to turn off, but that's kind of how you engage with different types of media from your experience and your kind of vantage point on it. And I agree with you on Andor. I watched the first three episodes. I think I was so in my head that I forgot to enjoy it. And by the end of it, I was like, I don't actually know what I just watched, because I was really focused on the messaging. And I was like, I love how they're portraying this one thing, but I didn't really take in the story that much. So I actually have to go rewatch it and remember to enjoy it this time.
Something that I think about, again, in the context of, you know, looking at Star Wars like a historian and all that, is it goes back to something, Vaughn, that you brought up earlier, is the fact that Star Wars storytelling doesn't happen in this linear fashion, that we jump around a lot between prequel, sequel, whatever, back and forth. We're kind of jumping all over the timeline. At a certain point, you might get a piece of Star Wars media that's in the original trilogy era. You might get something that's kind of in between prequels and OT. You might get High Republic, so it's hundreds of years before. I think in that way, what's interesting is that, like, there's a way in which, in doing that, like, Star Wars is kind of doing its own kind of historiography. There's a way, like, it's rewriting its own past. Like, okay, like, you think you know the relationship between Obi-Wan and Leia, and you've thought about it in a certain way, but here's this new piece of media, and here's this whole other facet of their relationship. Now all this other stuff means something totally different.
I love that. Yeah. It's not retconning, it's just history.
Yes, yeah, you're recontextualizing it the same way that you would do if you wrote a book and say, like, okay, well, you know, historians of all this time have, you know, thought about, I don't know, I'll use your example, Vaughn, like, have thought about, written about Superman in this way, but here's a different way to think about it over here, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, that again, that is the sort of work, that is the kind of stock and trade of historians, to constantly say, well, here's a new interpretation, here's new context, here's a perspective that we haven't looked at or thought about, or that's gotten ignored or marginalized, and it's going to change the way that we think about the Mexican-American War. I don't know why I thought about that, but there you go.
If you then add in things like Rogue One and Andor, what you end up with is, you know, all of the Star Wars that you've watched so far has basically been great man history. You know, you've got all of these big, powerful figures, and, like, they're the ones who sort out all of these issues. Well, actually, what if we look at something a little more from grassroots up, of, you know, a marginalized history, of people who do not have these amazing godlike powers, but, you know, they also interact with history and they also have their own experiences and they also make differences. You know, what do we think about that?
Oh my God, I love that idea that Rogue One and Andor are like the Hobbes bomb of Star Wars.
History. It's the age of Gilroy.
Tony Gilroy is Star Wars Eric Hobsbawm.
I love that. That is such a great way to look at it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we've had the Age of Empire, and now we have the Age of Rebellion, and it's defined from the grassroots.
Yes,
that's fantastic. Oh, I love this conversation. This is wonderful.
Yeah,
I'm having a lot of fun.
Me too. And I think, like, you know, to stick on the topic of Andor and even something like Rogue One, because I think that also leads to something else, which is that I think, you know, as a historian, one of the things that you get, like, if you talk about in the context of something like a Star Wars, is you do get your own kind of appreciation for, I guess, prequelist storytelling. Because, like, if you take something like an Andor, like a banned critique of a show like Andor, and, you know, you'll see this on Twitter every now and then, because that's a Twitter is the wretched hive of scum and villainy, you know, it's the wretched hive of bad takes. But you'll see the critique of, like, well, why are we getting this show? You know, we know how his story, like, we know he dies on Scarif. right? Like, that's a very bad critique of Andor, for example. But, you know, if you're sitting at this, looking at this like a historian, you're like, well, all the people I'm talking about are dead. Like, yeah, we know the ends of pretty... Yeah, like, we know that unless you do history that kind of reaches into contemporary things, pretty much everyone that you're studying and writing about is no longer with us. You know the end of their story. But you also understand the value of, well, there is something to be said to going back and saying, well, how did that person get to that final point? Or what were the things that informed and influenced their decisions and so on and so forth?
Yeah, one of the purest or kind of enduring messages or kind of key tenets of a historian is, how did we get to this point? Which, you know, means that we're always writing prequels in exactly the same way that you say, because it's always about how did these people or these events happen? How did it reach this particular scenario? And to understand that, you've got to go backwards. And you've got to understand the build up and the, you know, the societal pressures and all of those types of things.
So yeah, so moving on to, one of my questions here was talking about how is adopting a kind of lens as a historian change the way you consume Star Wars? And I think we sort of got into that a little bit already. The next place I want to go to, this shifts a little bit into like some of the stuff that Vaughn and I do on our respective shows, but then also gets into some of the things, Chris, that you have done particularly in your book. So, you know, we bring up these comparisons, these parallels between Star Wars stories and historical events. We look at, I don't know, the rise of the Empire in the prequels, and we compare it to the rise of fascist regimes in Europe, or we talk about the War on Terror and all of that in the early 2000s. We see all of these parallels and we talk about them and we make these comparisons. But I want to kind of get like the kind of bedrock level below that, which is, what's the value of drawing out these kind of comparisons? Like, what do we get out of it apart from just like, as historians, just this kind of visceral satisfaction in doing it? What's the value in saying, oh, you know, Palpatine accumulating power during the Clone Wars is like the Patriot Act? Like, what's the value in making a comparison like that, or anyone like that?
For me, it's kind of twofold. One, this is the question that I'm constantly justifying all of my work on because I study Christmas films. But there's something about innocuous media, innocent media, that we just watch for fun or escapism that has such deeper messages than we sometimes allow for. And it's not that they're trying to brainwash you or something, but they made conscious decisions to put certain things in these innocent films that are marketed to all age groups and all audiences, that you come away with ideas about politics, or in other films, being an American, or all of these things. And I think it's incredibly important to tell everyone that no art is non-political. There's nothing that is apolitical. And especially with Star Wars, wars is in the name. So that's something we're gonna expect. And we're told, like, it is a political film. So you should interrogate all of the subliminal kind of things that are in the film, and even the direct references of, why is Palpatine doing X, Y, and Z? And then the other side of that, one of my main goals with all of my work and podcasts and whatever is breaking down gatekeeping around academic history, because I think it's really important. Yeah. And as we've all said, like, there's an idea in society that history is an objective truth, and that is not right. That is absolutely not right. But if you don't go on to study history in university, then you kind of hold that idea for a long time until you're confronted with it. And I think that's why we're in a lot of the situations that we are in the US and in the UK. By bringing American history together with Star Wars, I think it makes a lot of the themes and the histories and the events of American history more accessible. That if you can understand how it worked in Star Wars, then you can start to see it in the real world too. So, like, that's my goal at least with bridging the two.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. You always get a stock response whenever I ask, you know, my students, you know, what's the point of studying? You know, you always get some kind of form of, you know, to learn the lessons of the past so you don't repeat them in the future. And that is true and fine, but I always think it's true and fine up to a point, because it suggests that, you know, there's going to be a situation at some point in your life that knowing that, you know, Henry VIII had six wives will somehow solve for. And I just, you know, I don't necessarily, you know, it's quite a flippant example, but I don't necessarily know if that moment's ever going to come. You know, I also wasn't planning on marching on, you know, Moscow in the winter. So, you know, I don't know what that lesson of the Second World War was supposed to do for me. But at the same time, being able to identify, you know, how particular moments have looked in the past is useful and informative. And knowing that, you know, certain types of things, whilst never necessarily identical to what they have been in the past, if we take, you know, say, Caesar and the Roman Republic into the Roman Empire, say someone like Napoleon, Hitler with the Weimar Republic, and, you know, Emperor Palpatine, they're not, you know, 100% accurate, complete mirror images of each other, but there are similarities between them. You know, certain things have happened in particular ways in the past, and they can look a little bit similar to that if they play out in other ways. But I feel that one of the most useful aspects of it is almost to help establish some kind of shared language. You know, if somebody tells me that, oh, you know, I think this is evil, whatever it is that they're talking about, how do I understand what they mean by evil? You know, what is their reference points for good and evil? But if somebody says, you know, oh, I saw this, it's like the Galactic Empire, there's something like, you know, there was a shared understanding of what that means, which means that it becomes much easier to talk about. That is incredibly useful. You know, it's exactly Vaughan's point. You know, if you can understand something in Star Wars, you can understand it in the real world as a way of translating things. But also that kind of wider element of, you know, recognizing that, exactly as Vaughan said, you know, no media is apolitical, no media is neutral. If somebody tells you that their media is apolitical and neutral, they're either lying or wrong. It was like a central question that I posed in, I think it's in the introduction of my book, you know, that when Star Wars speaks to us, it is trying to tell us something. You know, whether or not we agree with or accept their visions of the past, and there are definitely moments where it's a pretty wonky view of the past, it is trying to transmit something to us. Understanding that is useful and important for understanding the whole.
I'm fixated on your point about the shared language, because I think that's such a profound insight there. That, yeah, like, it gives you a kind of cultural cue in which to talk about things in the world.
Yeah. And you see it on Twitter all the time. You know, this isn't going to horribly date the episode particularly, but obviously over here in Britain recently, the Queen has died. And somebody on Twitter had a video of Charles and Camilla and various kind of royal courtiers and the like walking through a hall in London and sitting up on a stage with other kind of politicians and the like. And they put the Imperial March over the top of it as a musical cue. Now... You know, they're making a very clear comment about what they think about the monarchy and, you know, the British state and all of those different bits and pieces. And you don't have to agree with that point of view to understand what it is that they're saying, because we know what the Imperial March means. We know what the Galactic Empire is in its, you know, in its essence supposed to represent. And because we have that shared language, you don't have to go to any, you know, huge, extensive efforts to explain the wider point that you're trying to make. You can just make it with a piece of music.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And Vaughan, to something that you were saying earlier, I think a point that I really like, which is, you know, you talked about this idea of gatekeeping in academia and about, you know, the influence and the analysis flowing both ways, where in the sense of, like, you want to do the work of, on the one hand, you know, you take a piece of media like Star Wars and then say, like, okay, well, like, here it is situated in history, here's all the influences, here's all the context, but then you want to go sort of in the other direction also, and then talk about, like, put Star Wars in the context of, like, you know, using it as a lens to look at, you know, the real world and making comparisons in that way. And I think, like, in a sort of academic context, there's more comfort with the former kind of analysis than the latter kind. But I think you're right that both are important.
Yeah, I think it, well, thank you, but I think it's really, a helpful way to, I mean, as Chris just said, with kind of shared language, when you see a topic such as within corruption or indoctrination or bodily autonomy on Joy of Star Wars, and when you see those themes in Star Wars so well defined, like take corruption, there's literally a couple episode arc on Clone Wars about corruption on Mandalore, and they spell it out, and Ahsoka says, when you see these specific indicators of political corruption, you have to call it out. And they're telling children this, not only in the show but also as the show being marketed to children on Cartoon Network in the States, of how to identify political corruption. And that's a really important point. So if you can see it and learn from it in Star Wars, those are transferable skills.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
something we should really be encouraging.
There's
we learn from our media.
There's an amazing Rian Johnson quote that I think there was like a conversation years ago on Twitter, and you know, somebody asked the question, you know, what are you thankful to George Lucas for, or the like, and his response was that George Lucas made a 12-hour film for children about how fear of loss turns good people into fascists.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that's a pretty good description of the two trilogies that George Lucas worked on. You know, it is a children's film that telling kids, you know, this is what fascism looks like. And, you know, we think it's important that you should recognize it when it rocks up.
And it is.
Exactly.
It is rocking up.
It is important. So
we need to know that.
I'd quite like it if all adults recognized it as well.
Yes.
Yeah. It always blows my mind when fascists watch Star Wars and they're like, we love Luke. And it's like, do you? Are you sure?
Yeah.
For the research for my book, I went into the British Library and I found this pamphlet, it's a neo-Nazi pamphlet that they had called Star Wars, the Racial Nationalist Analysis, which explains Star Wars and Luke Skywalker as the symbol of Aryan power and majesty over the rest of the world. It's like, I mean, firstly, I don't think you watch Star Wars properly. I don't want to gatekeep Star Wars, but I honestly, guys, I think you got it wrong. But it's also that massive kind of disjuncture between what they're bringing to their cinema experience and what they're getting out of it. But also that kind of, that you know, that realisation that, you know, left to their own devices, the far right will fill a vacuum about what a media means and broadcast it to as many people as possible. So, you know, maybe we shouldn't surrender the ground about what these things actually mean or what we think they mean, because other people are going to be more than willing to let everybody know that they think that, you know, Luke Skywalker is some kind of proto-Adolf Hitler.
Yeah. Amen to all of that.
I think
that's why all of this work is so important, because it's like all of these things that we've said, it's about learning your history through something accessible like Star Wars, and it's about learning historiography, that there are different kinds of lenses to look at it, and it's about like all of these other views of how to interact with history, but also how to interact with media. And part of what all of us do in analyzing Star Wars from a historical point is teach media literacy and different ways of engaging with media. And I think that's just invaluable, especially now with so much media and so many different types of media. We need to really encourage that kind of critical thinking on what you're watching and what you're consuming at every level.
I want to go back to this idea that we've been talking about. You know, we've talked about situating Star Wars media within the context in which it was made, within the historical moment, and you know, looking at what the makers, you know, did and what they were thinking and what influences they might have brought to bear, you know, when they were making a movie or a book or whatever. And I want to come back to that idea, and I want to kind of talk about some of the potential limits in terms of that analysis. Because this question was prompted me by something, Chris, that you came up with in your book, that came up a couple of times, where I think it was particularly in the context of talking about the prequels, where you would write about how people would draw these comparisons between things that were happening in the prequels and then things that were happening contemporarily, particularly like in America around 9/11, war on terror, all that sort of stuff. And I think I already told you this on Twitter once, which is like the way that you like you blew my mind by making the comparison about between the burning Jedi Temple in Revenge of the Sith and the Twin Towers in New York. I've never seen that before. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, like that is the same. But like, so, you know, you pointed out how people are making these comparisons, but then at the same time in your book, I mean, this is just one example. There were a couple examples throughout that you noted in your book where you would find a quote from like George Lucas or from, you know, somebody else. And they'd be like, well, we wrote the script like 3 years before, you know, like we wrote this before any of these events happened. And it just so happened that the events paralleled. So, you know, when it comes to that kind of media analysis and intentionality, you know, I think about, like, you know, there was in the mid 20th century, I mean, the both of you will be familiar with this, but I mean, you know, some of the other listeners maybe also, like, there was a very famous essay written by Roland Barthes, the death of the author. And for listeners who aren't familiar with it, he was this French philosopher, and he wrote this essay in which he made the case for divorcing analysis of a text, like a piece of media, a book or something, from the intentionality or the context of the particular author. Because one of the arguments that he was making is that, you know, when people were discussing a book or analyzing a book, they would say, well, the author intended, you know, this symbolism, or they didn't intend that symbolism. And his argument was, forget about all of that. Like, if you read the symbolism in there, it's in there. Like, just don't think about what the author is trying to do. But then I think about in history, we have less license as historians to do that. You know, when we look at a movie or we look at a book and we say, well, this book is about this event or is a commentary on this, there will always be a little pushback to say, like, well, how do you know that? You know, like, how, like, where are you getting that kind of argument or reading from? Like, it always has to usually be rooted in something tangible, something that the author wrote somewhere else, an interview, whatever else it may be. There usually has to be some of that backup. So I'm curious about you guys, your thoughts on that, which is that, like, can we take something like the prequels and then say, like, oh, this is about post 9/11 America, even in a context where, let's say, George Lucas may come out and say, well, when I was writing this, it wasn't about post 9/11 America.
What I did with the book is, and this is the part of this kind of, in regards to the what you were talking about in kind of, you know, the intentions of the filmmaker versus the reception of the audience, goes straight back to Vaughan's point right at the beginning of the podcast about, you know, recognizing that the audience are bringing things with them. And, you know, that example of the burning Jedi Temple, you know, I said, I remember sitting in a cinema in 2005, looking at that and knowing what it meant. And what it was, you know, what it reminded me of, what it was trying to convey to me. Whether or not, you know, that's exactly what George Lucas meant or not is pure, you know, death of the author, you know, divorcing the creator from the creation. And, you know, some of it is clearly, or some of the things that happen, I think, is clearly not designed to kind of make the audience think certain things. And I use some examples of some of the Expanded Universe books that come out at the time, which are, you know, have been written, you know, months and months and months in advance of 9/11, come out after 9/11, and can now be read in a 9/11 way. But they can't have been written like that because 9/11 hadn't happened yet, regardless of whether or not, you know, they're indicative of a wider kind of American moment in the lead up to kind of the what happens in 9/11 and that kind of post-Soviet moment. You're right in that it is problematic for historians, because being able to say, you know, I've searched my feelings, I know it to be true, is not a footnote. Yeah. It's, you know, it's that meme about, you know, in ancient Greece you could just write down, well, I dreamt this and therefore I know that it's true. My reference point for this, or the way that I approach it, it's J.R.R. Tolkien. He is the answer to he's the solution to the problem for me, because, you know, I'm a First World War historian of sorts. J.R.R. Tolkien serves in the First World War. He's in the trenches on the Somme. He gets trench fever, gets invalided out, and then later writes, you know, The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. And lots of people say to him, wow, you know, we've looked at these battle sequences and, you know, the descriptions of the dead marshes and, you know, the various aspects of conflict and alliances and the like that you talk about. There's loads and loads of First World War stuff in here, J.R.R. And he used to get super angry about it. He's like, no, I don't write to talk about the First World War. There's no First World War symbolism, is there? If you keep asking me about this, I'm just going to get upset and refuse to talk to you. Stop asking me if it's about the First World War. It's about hobbits and orcs and a faraway land. And it's absolutely 100% fine for him to say that. I have literally no problems with that being his position. I just don't believe him. And that's the point for me, in that, you know, whether consciously or unconsciously for him, I think there is First World War stuff in it, because it's clearly got loads of First World War stuff in it. You know, George Lucas and Dave Filoni can say as much as they want about, you know, oh, you know, when we did the prequels, we weren't, you know, when we did Revenge of the Sith and when we did Attack of the Clones, we weren't making points about George W. Bush. And when we made those episodes about torture in the Clone Wars, we definitely weren't talking about, you know, waterboarding or, you know, extreme interrogation. And they can say all of that. It's fine. I just don't believe them. I don't believe that this is a coincidence. These things happen to be happening at the same time as it happens to be happening in the real world. And that's kind of the position that I take on it. I just don't think it's a coincidence. I don't believe them. And it's fine that I don't believe them, and it's fine that they say something that I don't believe.
I think that's exactly right. It goes right back to what you were saying earlier, Chris, that the creators don't exist in a political vacuum or a historical vacuum. They are humans who are experiencing the world in real time and creating art then. And they can say that it's not about certain things, but they're going to have influences if they watch the news in the morning and then go and sit down and write. One of the other things that I would highlight here is that I used to do classical reception. As I mentioned briefly, with one of my theses was on a comic book that used classical reception, which is when we look at things in the modern world that use ancient characters in them. So that one was about a comic book from Marvel or Timely Comics at the time, about the goddess Venus. The reason for classical reception is essentially because the audience already has a familiarity with the character and with the myths and all of the things that come with it. So it's heavily reliant on what does the audience already know about this character, and then what is the creator going to change about it. And I think it's the same kind of approach with Star Wars and other films and all of those things, that you have to think about the audience before you think about the creator. Because the audience is going to have all of these influences that the creator also might have, but we can't prove anything one way or another, whether this person definitely saw Star Wars on this day and then went on to create whatever. So I think we exist in a kind of limbo area where we do have the burden of proof and evidence for writing history. But we're also analyzing literature and art and films. That is about the audience more than it's about the creator, in my opinion. It's about the influences on the art and the influences the art has on everyone else and the world around it. So I don't think we can ever 100% prove these things. If you can make the argument, somebody will let you write it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Vaughn, about that point about in history, there is always that degree of kind of, there's that epistemological challenge of like of trying to prove what may or may not have been in a person's head at any given time. Yeah. That absent having some document where like, here's what they were thinking about this thing, that it's
which it they could have lied.
Be, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that kind of connects back to Chris's point. Yeah. And I think is also a kind of valuable part of an important part of historical work. And it's one thing that I think particularly when you try to teach historical work is a very tight needle to thread, which is you're trying to find that line of like, what is the precise balance of, on the one hand, where you do the thing where you call bullshit sometimes and you say like, okay, you're saying you didn't do that, but like you did, like you're saying you didn't write about the First World War, but this is about the First World War. But then also finding the balance of like, you do want to take, there is a degree into which you do want to take people at their word and say the word do reflect something about their mentality. And you're trying to find like, what is that Goldilocks middle look like?
With figures like George Lucas, the way that, because you're exactly right, and also, you know, history is replete with people who, you know, are getting things across using language that might seem slightly contradictory. You know, quite a lot of work around the Holocaust is, you know, about awful Nazis who are, you know, not quite saying let's go outside and kill everybody, but clearly want people to go outside and kill everybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's about what the audience takes from that speech rather than necessarily mm-hmm. the particular words that are being used. But with that kind of that Goldilocks moment of that you're talking about, was like, how do you, because if you start going, well, it doesn't matter what anybody says, isn't it? Well, how do you figure out what anybody ever actually meant? And the handy thing about a figure like George Lucas is that, you know, he said loads in the past about, you know, his use of politics in you know, in the original trilogy and his wider inspirations and the ideas and that for it. And what you can end up doing is basically going, okay, one of these two things is true. Either A, George Lucas either didn't realise, or is that he put lots of politics in the prequel trilogy, or he put lots of politics in the prequel trilogy and said otherwise. Alternatively, the other thing that therefore could be true is that George Lucas was super political in the original trilogy and then decided to stop being political in the prequel trilogy and just mm-hmm. made a weird apolitical thing that has no politics or contemporary reference in it. Which one of those two feels and seems more likely given what we know about George Lucas?
Right.
Exactly that. It's the balance and this happy medium of I've done the historical research, I've analyzed what the kind of mainstream views were at the time. We can pull these together, and with the creator's like actual words on it, we can understand what they were trying to get across. I think it is a historical undertaking. It really is to analyze these things.
I did an interview with a website for when the book came out, and they posted their article about it on their Facebook and their Twitter page. Good Lord, a lot of people on their Facebook and Twitter page were very angry about it or what they thought I'd said. And it's all kind of fortunately, they'd never quite made the mental leap of going, oh, we could actually go and direct these comments, you know, straight to the person, you know, straight to Chris himself. They never actually, you know, bothered looking me up on Facebook or Twitter, but they also didn't bother reading the actual article itself. So all of the comments in it are basically, you know, oh, you know, there's nothing political in it. You know, it's just a film. And, you know, here, you know, if there is anything political about it, you know, here's who I think that Barack Obama is Emperor Palpatine, really, or, you know, the Nazis are the Democrats and all this kind of weird conspiracy theory stuff. But there's an element of, this isn't just me saying it. I'm literally quoting George Lucas in the article that you're all commenting on, where he says, you know, very clearly, this is what I was doing. And that element of the idea that we'd just be kind of saying something without evidence, I find is very peculiar. That, you know, we wouldn't come with quotes and we wouldn't come with receipts, but it kind of goes to that element of, you know, you're making an argument about something, therefore you're politicizing history, and that's not what historians do, and therefore I don't need to read the article because you've already diverted away from what I believe the role of a historian in my head is. And it's just very weird.
We haven't really, like, you know, talked about him in this context, but also like George Lucas is also kind of an interesting figure to talk about this in the context of the history of Star Wars, as somebody who has on many occasions attempted to rewrite the history of Star Wars.
Yeah.
He has constantly told many different narratives about the extent to which certain things were or were not intended or planned or whatever. So he's just like an interesting, that's just a little sidebar. Like, George Lucas is an interesting person in all this.
Yeah,
when
George
we talk
Lucas
about creators
is not,
and intentionality. Yeah.
He is not the best source on the thought process of George Lucas at times, and that makes it very, very complicated to talk about this.
Yeah, yeah, you know, you made a good point, Chris, about, you know, you were talking, and you know, this gets back to, you know, things that Yvonne were also saying about sort of reception and the way things are heard, even if they're not said in certain ways. Like, yeah, like that's always a challenge, I think, when getting, like, particularly, you know, when you're working with people, like working with students and trying to get them to, like, sort of like think like a historian. Like, I remember always having this, you know, coming around this issue when trying to get students to appreciate, like, ideas or ideologies. There is, you know, to that point about balance, like, there is a degree into which sometimes you'll see, like, too much skepticism or too much cynicism. So, you know, you'll get something like, I don't know, like, take like Soviet communism, whatever. And, you know, you might get students are saying like, well, this is all this was all just kind of like this is all about like power and like the leaders were just trying to, you know, stay in charge. And it's like, oh, like, yeah, you like, yeah, you can interrogate like a Stalin or whatnot and ask like how long, you know, to what extent do they sincerely believe things. But like, then like there were also millions of Soviets who like really thought that they were building the utopia. And like, you got to take that seriously too. So yeah, there's that kind of balance there. I think a good kind of final question that I have, or way to kind of wrap up our conversation, and this kind of moves away from, you know, just looking at like Star Wars and history and the intersections, and kind of gets more to, there's a more question like about and for folks like us, the people who are, you know, writing books about the intersection of Star Wars and history, or, you know, like Vaughn and I are doing podcasts where we're looking at these intersections, talking about comparisons and such. What responsibilities do you think content creating historians have? If we're going to operate in this Venn diagram space, and we're going to put out books and podcasts and whatever, and say, like, here, we're going to talk about Star Wars and history, and we're going to make these parallels, and we're going to draw these things out, and we're going to look at these kind of historically. What sort of responsibilities do you think we have when we're doing that?
This has been something I've been thinking a lot about recently because of recent events. I have very suddenly had a large platform kind of thrust upon me. It feels like a very heavy responsibility. The main goal, as I mentioned earlier, is to break down gatekeeping. And I think public scholarship is one of the most important things that a historian can do, because someone with a podcast that has however many 50,000 listeners is going to reach more people than a historian publishing in a paywalled journal. Gatekeeping, breaking down gatekeeping is one thing, that we need to be explicit in our terminology and explain things to people who are not specialists in history, and explain things like what historiography means in plain terms. And then also reminding people and trying to get the message to as many people as possible that history is not an objective truth, and that there are different interpretations, as we've been saying this whole time. And specifically with Star Wars, I think it's really important to say that you might have a different interpretation of the film than I do, and you might have a different interpretation of the history that I present in our episodes. And that's okay, because that's the point here, is to start a dialogue, start a conversation about these larger topics like corruption and indoctrination and bodily autonomy. What can we draw out of the actual real world history and also the filmic history, and kind of marry together to understand our own thoughts about them in the present? So I think those would be the main responsibilities, is making sure that we get the point of what history is across, and the kind of goals that we're trying to hit by writing history and sharing it with other people.
Yeah, I think I would kind of wholeheartedly agree with that. There used to be a professor at Sussex, University of Sussex, where I did my PhD. He sadly died a few years ago, but he used to be very fond of saying that if it matters to people, it should matter to historians. And I think that is something that helps historians kind of decide, you know, what is it that we should be looking at and the like. But also it's that breaking down gatekeeping an element, but also removing some of the elitist snootyism of the field of history. You know, I can't imagine that any of us are, you know, have not encountered somebody going, why on earth would you waste time looking at something like Star Wars? It doesn't matter. So, well, it matters to people. So it should matter to us. We are not divorced from, you know, the people around us. Firstly, it's about, you know, not fencing off large parts of culture and saying these aren't worthy. You know, the people who make them are not worthy of consideration. The people who enjoy them are not worthy of consideration. But also, to speak to Vaughan's point, it's about multiplicity of voices. Exactly your point. You know, other people will get other interactions and experiences or understandings from watching a Star Wars film than I will, and that's fine. It's good that is the case, but also that realizing that if you want to make, you know, say Star Wars decide, okay, yeah, no, we want to make another film about, you know, the Empire, it's fine. If you hire somebody like me, you know, a white middle class heteronormative man from Britain, you'll get a very particular vision of the Empire. And if you then get somebody who, you know, exactly like me again, to write a history of it, you'll get a very particular historical understanding of that piece of media. But if you hire different people at both of those stages, you'll get something different. And that's also important and interesting, that, you know, there is no sole understanding of what fascism looks like, or no sole understanding of what colonialism looks like. Quite often, the versions that we interact with tend to come from those who have built empires owned colonies. That is a narrowing and a gatekeeping in itself. That, you know, it's important to broaden the opportunity for people to make material like Star Wars. And then potentially in the future, you know, a better book about the history and politics of Star Wars will be written by somebody who is nothing like me and gets loads more interesting information out of those films than I did, because I just don't see it. Because I don't have the reference points, I don't have the cultural touchstones, I don't have the cultural process that enables me to see things in a particular way that is just as valid as my way. So it's about democratizing production and democratizing analysis.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree with what both of you have said on that point. I think particularly, I think, like, underscoring that line about, like, the elitism and the gatekeeping, I think is really, really important. Because I think, like, one of the big things that I sort of keep in mind, particularly like when I make my things, and I'm sure both of you have this in your mind also, is that, like, on the one hand, you know, you do want to introduce people to, and you want to talk about complex things, whether it's like complex things that happened in the past or certain, you know, concepts and so on. But then there's also that element of, like, meeting folks where they are and not kind of talking down to people, that I think is really, really important. Like, there, mm-hmm. like, there is an obligation on our part to kind of speak plainly and yes. convey things in a straightforward manner, which is not always a virtue that is recognized within academia.
No.
And so I think particularly, you know, for folks like us who are making things that are, you know, overtly public facing in this way, whether it is a book of the sort that you wrote, Chris, or it's, you know, podcasting like Vaughn and I do, I think there is that obligation of, you know, being plain and straightforward. And, you know, it's okay to talk about things that, like, you got to get into a lot of nitty gritty and there's a lot to digest, but there's also, like, you got to convey that as straightforwardly as possible.
It's good to get into those nitty gritty things. And to last night on my Twitter, I introduced people to Louis Althusser's version of Gramscian hegemony and Marxism, the ideological state apparatus. And people were engaging with it. And I got messages mm-hmm. of people saying, like, I didn't know what this kind of theoretical idea was. And yeah. now I do. And, like, that's so important that we
we
can use the terminology, but we have to explain it.
Yes,
that's how we grow this kind of public knowledge and perceptions and stuff. Like, we should definitely be plain in our language, but not afraid to use the jargon if we explain it well.
Yes. Yeah, yes. Exactly. Absolutely. And then I think the other thing that's important in anything that we do, like anything that we make. And I mean, I think this is very much clearly, a carryover from the academic context, is bringing your receipts.
Yes.
Right. Like if you're going to make a particular case of, like, here's this parallel, I think, like, you can see X in Y, or, you know, what, you know, A, Star Wars media is about B, you know, real world event. It's about, like, you got to bring the proof. Like, you got to lay out everything, again, sort of as clearly and straightforwardly as possible. So I think that is also mm-hmm. important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's no point kind of ring fencing off the meaning of something behind a bunch of stupid words that no human being would ever rationally say out loud. But also, if you assert something, you need to be able to point people at a thing that shows them that, or shows mm-hmm. them why you think that. Because otherwise, it's just, it's random, it's lacking in foundation, theoretical static, for want of a better phrase, because no one can access it, and no one can use the shared language, because you've mm-hmm. you've blocked it away, and nobody can, you know, do a shared analysis of something because you haven't shown them what you mean.
All right. So I think on that note, we will wrap up our conversation. I mean, this has been every bit as fantastic as I hoped it would be, and more.
I mean, loved all of this. Yeah. Like, every minute yes. of this was fantastic.
Yes.
Are we going to do, exactly. like, we should just, you know, just keep coming back and doing more of these. So there's been some more
Yes,
stars.
Exactly. I would love that. All right. So, in order to, you know, to wrap up the episode, I will do what I always do with closing guests. So the first thing is that I will ask each of you to recommend to the listeners a piece of Star Wars media that they should check out. And that should be book, movie, comic, canon, legends, whatever. Vaughn, I'll start with you.
I will always be an advocate for Rebels. I think more people need to watch Rebels and fall in love with it and just consume it to your dying day. I don't know. It's just so good. And part of this kind of Eric Hobsbawm side of the social history of Star Wars, where you feel the war through a specific Rebel cell. And it's just such a different type of Star Wars media. I think everybody should watch Rebels.
God, hear, hear. Correct. I love Rebels. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm.
So good. So good.
And again, is it a children's show? Are we sure? Because...
Exactly.
There's a lot in there.
Yes.
I finally convinced my brother to watch it recently. After years of telling him, you need to watch Rebels, he was just messaging me the whole time of like, oh my God. Oh my God, this is so good. He was like... I think I'm in love with Hera. And I was like, of course you are. Everyone is.
Yeah, and you should be.
How it works.
So it's not... what I'm going to recommend is a piece of Star Wars media, which I love. It's not like my favorite piece of Star Wars media, because that's a, you know, that's a whole hour and a half podcast of itself trying to figure that out. But I think of something that people can read today and use and understand is Alexander Freed's Alphabet Squadron trilogy. Because... those books came out and I was like, oh, cool. It's like the X-Wing Expanded Universe series, and it's going to be about, you know, TIE fighters and X-Wings, and it's going to be pew-pew stuff, and it's going to be fun. And it is fun, but it's not like that. It is a genuinely fascinating exploration of the grueling, traumatizing, dehumanizing experience of war, of what even... fighting on what we would, you know, largely consider to be the right side, who are winning, what this conflict and what participating in this violence is doing to them in a, you know, a physical, a moral, a philosophical, a mental and material way. But it also contains some of my favourite critiques of the Empire, and particularly Palpatine himself, written in a way that could quite easily have come out of a book on the Second World War and writing about Hitler. It is fascinatingly and beautifully and wonderfully constructed, the way that that Alexander Freed describes Palpatine as a vicious, petty, cruel man who does vicious, petty, cruel things, because that's who he is. And, you know, sometimes petty, cruel, vindictive, horrible, arrogant men with power do awful, awful things because that's who they are. And that's you know, the part of, you know, a significant part of the motivation of their actions. And I just think it's fantastic. I think it's a really important, interesting way at looking at, you know, these great men version of history and going, okay, yeah, you know, they've got all of these ideology, but they're also garbage human beings. And garbage human beings with power do awful, awful things. And we should recognize that. And not necessarily turn them into the supervillain with this Machiavellian plan. Sometimes people commit violence just because they're awful. And I think it's great.
That sounds brilliant.
Yeah. They're not the lightest of books, but I really heartily recommend reading them. They are fantastic.
I've read 2 out of 3. I still need to get to Victory's Price. I haven't gotten there yet, but I will.
It's got a really interesting payoff element to the end, again, which is about participation in fascism and complicity and a system designed to make people complicit in it. And it's really good.
All right. And then the very last thing is for both of you to plug your stuff where people can find you. I will then go reverse and start with Chris first.
I've been saying this. One of the benefits of being probably the only Chris Kempshield to have ever existed is that all of my social media branding's real easy. You know, I'm at Chris Kempshill on Twitter, I'm at Chris Kempshill on Instagram. You'll get a variety of different outputs from me on that, you know, a mix of Star Wars stuff and First World War stuff and political stuff and, you know, Simpsons GIFs and that type of, you know, high kind of critical engagement. I've been completely forgetting to plug this for every podcast I've done so far. I also co-present a podcast about the portrayal of the First World War in popular culture, and it's called Oh What a Lovely Podcast. Ooh. That's been going for some time now. We're about 30-31 episodes in, and they come out monthly, and that's a lot of fun. We did one very early on about Star Wars when I was writing the book, which was a lot of fun. And, you know, we've done, you know, recently we did like The Red Baron and Snoopy as a way of understanding portrayals of the air war in the First World War, which was good fun. I should probably plug the book, I imagine. You know, you can get the history and politics of Star Wars in like a variety of book places. I don't know if it's the type of thing you'd want to put in the show notes. I can give you like, there's a, if you buy it through the Routledge website, I can give like a 25% discount code for people because cheaper books are good. So, you know, I can send you the code and you can put that in the show notes or I can read it out loud. I don't know what's going to be easiest, but it feels like, you know, getting a quarter off of a book feels like, you know, a net good for people.
Yeah. I'll put that in the episode description. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. I'll send that over to people. So yeah, it only works through the Routledge website, but I think they pretty much do free international shipping. So yeah, I think that's a good way of getting cheap books.
All right, Vaughn.
I do not have synchronicity across my social medias, but on Twitter, I'm at gvaughnjoy is my personal/professional account. And then Joy of Star Wars is at Joy of Star Wars on Twitter. Impressions of America, we look at history and culture through various lenses and kind of whatever we're feeling at the time. We did an episode on the history of WWE, for example, and professional wrestling. And then there's all sorts of stuff over there. So that's at USA Impressions on Twitter. And then my fourth Twitter account is at Focus Hollywood for a new podcast that will be coming out soon on the history of Hollywood called Hollywood in Focus. But that tag was taken.
All right, Chris, Vaughn, thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what to expect on the next episode? Episode 44 drops on October 24th. And on that episode, I'm going to be looking at a topic that I was going to originally do earlier in the year and then ultimately decided to shelve because of when things were coming out. But now it's a topic I want to circle back to because it's one that I'm really interested in. So it is going to be an episode looking at the character of one, formerly Darth, now just Maul. And it is going to be an episode about Maul, and it is also going to be an episode about existentialism. So there's a very famous quote from Freddie Prinze Jr., if I'm remembering right, where he compares Maul to the Greek mythical figure Sisyphus. And Sisyphus, as it happens, also figures in a very important text in the philosophy of existentialism. It is an essay, a book written by a French philosopher by the name of Albert Camus called The Myth of Sisyphus. So on the next episode, on episode 44, I am going to look at the story of Darth Maul and what connections we can draw between it and the philosophy, the worldview of existentialism. I think it's going to be a really, really interesting one. And yeah, so and looking at this analogy between Maul and Sisyphus and how there's an additional layer to it that I think is really, really interesting. So do look out for that one. Until then, make sure you're subscribed to the show. Please rate and review the show if you're able to do so. If you're not already following the show on Twitter, you can do so at A Larger View Pod. And until next time, look for the Force, and you will always find me.